We did one for Mercedes, which again was very unique and very simple. It was about this guy, Raymond, who had never tried ice cream before. And it was a great commercial. And it talked about Raymond never having ice cream. And he waited and, he would watch other people have ice cream. But he was, and then one day Raymond decided to have ice cream. And then all of a sudden it cuts to a Mercedes logo. And then the last 10 seconds, it was for Mercedes. But it was so well done and so unique. But the score was very, very, very unique.
Welcome to Audio Branding, the hidden gem of marketing. Sound plays a more important role in human behavior and our decision-making than you may realize. In this podcast, I'll help you understand the art and science of sound so you can better influence others in business and your life. I'm your host, Jody Krangel. Let's delve a little deeper. Here's the first part of my conversation with Ted Rosnick. My next guest moved back to Toronto from Boston in 1974 after attending Berklee College of Music. He soon began working as a studio drummer, but his passion for audio production quickly led him to start his own jingle production company, Rosnick Productions, in 1975. Through hard work and dedication, he rapidly established himself as Canada's top audio producer and audio director for commercials. He went on to partner up with Steve McKinnon in 1990, forming RMW Music. For decades, they were the top music production company in Canada before selling to Vapor Music in 2016. Since the sale, he's remained with Vapor as a creative director, continuing to bring his expertise and passion to many projects and to the industry. His work is recognized not just in Canada, but globally, having shaped the sound of major brands like IKEA, Molson, Subaru, Mercedes, Peroni, and Heinz, among many others. Over his five-decade career, he's earned hundreds and hundreds of advertising awards for his music and sound design, always pushing creative boundaries with fresh ideas and meticulous attention to detail. All things we definitely appreciate here. Beyond advertising, he's made his mark in sound design and music for feature films and feature documentaries, and he is also the executive producer and audio director of the well-known advertising podcast IOFA with Aaron Starkman. He's mentored countless emerging talents over the years, a role he takes great pride in. In February of 2025, he decided to retire from the advertising industry after an illustrious 50-year career. He now enjoys spending time at his cottage in Northern Ontario with family and friends, playing the drums and catching Raptors games. His name is Ted, or Theo, Rosnick, and getting the opportunity to speak with someone who has such a rich knowledge of the advertising industry and how it's developed over the years, not to mention how much sound has played a part in that, is a real treat. If you want to know where advertising has been, where it is now, and where it might be going in the future, this is a discussion you will not want to miss. As always, if you have questions for my guest, you're welcome to reach out through the links in the show notes. If you have questions for me, visit audiobrandingpodcast.com, where you'll find a lot of ways to get in touch. Plus, subscribing to the newsletter will let you know when the new podcasts are available, along with other interesting bits of audio-related news. And if you're getting some value from listening, the best ways to show your support are to share this podcast with a friend and leave an honest review. Both those things really help, and I'd love to feature your review on future podcasts. You can leave one either in written or in voice format from the podcast's main page. I would so appreciate that. And now, here's my conversation with Ted Rosnick.
Thanks so much for joining me, Ted. You've had a pretty busy week, I'm imagining. So congratulations on your induction into Canada's Marketing Hall of Legends, because that's amazing. What was that like?
It was very surreal. I actually said this in my speech on Friday night. I'd actually never heard of the show or the honor of becoming a member of the Hall of Legends. But so when they emailed me, I was shocked and excited. And then when they called me and said that I actually, there was a short list or a long list, and then I was on the short list, and then they called me and said I actually got in. So that was very exciting.
Well, yeah. Congratulations. That yeah, is a lifetime achievement. I mean, it's fantastic. So, yeah, and well 50 deserved.
50 years. Yeah, 50 yeah. years in the business. So, yeah.
Well deserved.
I'm a legend, man.
That's why you're here.
There you go.
Yeah. But I usually start off by asking you a question about an early memory of how sound moved you. Do you have one of those?
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to hear about it.
Can it be music?
Totally.
Yeah.
Anything that really impresses you. Yeah.
Well, my earliest memory of, I don't know if it's my earliest, but it's the one that impacted me the most, was seeing the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show.
You know, you are not the first person to tell me that one.
and that changed everything for me.
Yeah.
That's when I knew I wanted to be a musician. I wanted to be a guitar player, and that's what I was at the beginning. And then I transitioned into drums. But I even have an amazing photograph of the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show the first time. Beautiful.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. It's really nice. Yeah.
What was it about them that really drew you to them?
I had never heard that kind of music before. I'd heard, you know, rock and roll and, you know, but that British invasion kind of, that was the start of it for me. And, it was just the next day at school, that was a Sunday night. So the next day in school, I think I was in grade six. Yeah. Like everybody was talking about it. It was like, and then within about 2 weeks, everybody was wearing Beatle boots and Beatle shirts. And,
cutting their hair that way.
Well, or not. My parents, my parents were strict about that, which is really weird because my dad was an artist and he was an interior designer, but he was also an artist and taught at OCAD. But yeah, they didn't let me get Beatle boots or anything. but a lot of my friends did in school. So anyway.
Wow. Yeah.
Such is life. Yeah.
I can just imagine the frenzy.
Yeah, it was big. It was really big.
Yeah. You know, I was just speaking with a fellow named Andy Gessner, who was on this podcast, and he had quoted that exact same appearance as his early memory as well.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I find that that's...
So you're talking to the old people.
Well, I mean, these are all things that shape our sound environments later into life. I mean, we all have our moments. That just happens to be a particularly iconic one.
It is. I mean, I knew at that moment I wanted to be a musician.
Yeah, yeah. And you went
and
into
I already
jazz,
had music
right?
around my life, but
of that, course.
But I did go into jazz. I went to Berklee College of Music, thinking I wanted to be a jazz musician. And one of my best friends at the time, great jazz guitar player named Joey Goldstein, a local guy in Toronto, he and I went down together to Berklee, and we were in bands together. And you know, I really wanted to be a jazz musician. And then I got back to Toronto and I was connected with the really good jazz players and the young jazz players. And I knew Mo Kaufman really well because his son was a very close friend of mine, or still is. And I noticed that the best of the best of them were all also postmen during the day, because they weren't making any money as jazz players. And
I see.
I was just being realistic with myself, thankfully, at that time. And I decided I didn't want to be a starving musician. And I had grown up in a certain lifestyle. Like, we weren't like wealthy, but, you know, middle class and had nice things. And I just decided that I did not want to be a postman. That's really what the decision was. And I lucked into becoming a studio drummer. And I played in bands, and I didn't do a lot of touring, which is probably a good thing.
probably.
Yeah. Knowing all the people in my life that have done a lot of touring, it sounds like I didn't miss much. And so the studio drumming led me to meet my first business partner, a guy named Lenny Bloom, who is a film screenwriter. He did write all of Ivan Reitman's movies, starting with Meatballs and then everything after that.
Wow.
And so we formed the Jingle Company together because A woman I was dating, her sister was a producer at McConnell Advertising, and they were looking for an Orange Crush jingle. And they had gone to all the big houses in town and couldn't get something that everybody liked. And she just said to me one night, "Hey, do you want to take a crack at, an Orange Crush jingle?" And I had never done a jingle, nor had I really even thought about jingles before that. And so I knew that Lenny, who was in the studio band with me, had been doing them. And I just said, "Hey, do you want to do this?" We did it. We went into the studio together at after our gig at 1 o'clock in the morning and recorded everything ourselves with one singer. And I showed up at the office of McConnell Advertising around 9 o'clock in the morning with a tape and said, "Hey, here it is." And they loved it.
Thanks for taking the time to listen. Quick question. Do you know anyone else who could benefit from hearing more about how powerful sound can be? If so, would you mind sharing this podcast with them? It would mean so much to me. Now, I'll stop interrupting and let you get back to the show.
What do you think
Little.
made them choose you as opposed to one of the big places? Like, I'm curious
Well,
as to what they heard that really made them like, wow.
we kind of broke the law.
Okay. I mean,
There was a
how?
little bit of copyright infringement involved.
Oh.
There was a song called Kathy's Clown.
Oh,
And so,
okay.
and I didn't know anything about the jingle business, and I didn't know anything about copyright. And so we just took that melody and changed the lyrics.
I see.
And I
Okay.
can't sing, but it was something like Orange Crush. I can't do it. Forget it. Never mind. I'm a pretty good drummer.
Was worth a try.
It was worth a try, yeah. And that's why they loved it, because they knew the song already. And I don't know if they were aware of it, and nobody was concerned about the copyright infringement. And in fact, back then, which was 1976, nobody was talking about copyright infringement in commercials. And it was only when Tom Waits in the 80s, I think, nailed a potato chip company or something for doing that, using one of his songs and just parodying the lyrics. And once he sued them and got a lot of money, then everybody got really conscious of it, and then it just stopped.
Yeah, or became licensed, I
Well,
guess.
no, that's what we did.
Like
We
in
started
sync,
license
you know?
we yeah we had
Yeah.
we had to license the music, and which back then was very different from the way it is now. And the money, like the
Yeah.
like we were licensing James Brown for $5,000, but
Oh,
then
wow.
later down the line we licensed Bittersweet Symphony for $750,000. So things changed. And I also got sued for $17.4 million for copyright infringement, which in fact it wasn't. We did
Wow.
it. Yeah, we did a McDonald's commercial. You're probably too young to remember this, but it was for Twisty Fries. And McDonald's came out with these French fries that were twisty. And the commercial was about a farmer who had set up these massive amplifiers in his field, and he played the twist, the Chubby Checker song
I love it.
to
Okay.
his potatoes, and they
To get
became.
them to, okay, got
And
it.
so, but we knew about licensing back then,
Yeah.
and Chubby Checker didn't write the song, nor did he originally perform it. A guy named Hank Ballard wrote it and performed it in 1958, and it actually went to the top of the Black Billboard charts. And in 1960, Dick Clark and his wife had heard about this new dance craze called the twist, but it was much more suggestive than they wanted to put on white television, white middle America TV. And so, and Hank Ballard's version was a little raunchier overall. And he invented the twist, like the actual dance also. But Dick Clark auditioned a ton of people and ended up with this guy. His last name was something Irving, and he was a male impersonator. He did Fats Domino and Elvis and all, artists like Chuck Berry and all those guys, and he was really good at that. And so Dick Clark and his wife wanted to name him Fats Domino or what, so Chubby Checker. And so that's how that came about, and they put him on, and it just soared to the top of the charts in 60, and was number one. And then it actually went back up into the top of the charts in 62, which is really weird. And so everybody, when they think of the twist, thought of Chubby Checker. And so we did this commercial and it was great and everybody was loving it. And then all of a sudden this lawyer, who I probably shouldn't mention his name.
Probably not.
Probably not. But I hate him.
Okay.
I really do.
Not a good guy. Okay.
Not a good, and we called him he's an ambulance chaser.
Oh, okay.
And so we got a phone call. I got a phone call from him on a Friday afternoon, like at 3 o'clock. Hey, can I come and meet with you and Steve McKinnon, who was my partner at the time. And he comes to our office like at 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon and says, if you give me $300,000 right now, I'll make this go away. Otherwise, I'm suing you guys for many millions of dollars. And I told him to leave my office. I was like, who is this guy? The reason being is we licensed everything from Hank, including a sound alike of his voice. Right. So because we did do a sound alike of it. And the problem, the smoking gun. So this lawyer had a group of students that would watch TV commercials and look for this thing, these kinds of copyright infringement. So he didn't do his homework. He immediately
and
launched.
And clearly they didn't either.
Right. And so all of a sudden on the Monday morning, there was a big press conference at the Sutton Place Hotel. And it was McDonald's is being sued for $17.4 million for copyright infringement of the Chubby Checker song, The Twist. And the McDonald's was named as the main thing. And then Vickers and Benson was the advertising agency. And then Ted Rosnick and Steve McKinnon, and then Rosnick Productions and Big Top Productions, which was my part. They were the partners to make. We were called Rosnick McKinnon. And so we were named four times in this lawsuit.
Wow.
No, five times. I'm sorry, because Rosnick McKinnon was named
they
also.
They really wanted to get you.
Well, and we were the smallest pockets. Like we, you know, and
you were the low-hanging fruit.
And well, the advertising agency on day one of this indemnified McDonald's because it was their client and they didn't want to lose the account. So the biggest pockets were off the hook. And for 5 years, we fought this thing, spent many hundreds of thousands of dollars, which we could not recoup from Chubby because, and I didn't blame Chubby for this at all. Like he was a guy that was driving around in a tour bus playing in Kitchener at Lulu's or whatever it was called in Kitchener's and not making any money. And, you know, and this guy said, hey, do you want to make millions of dollars? And of course, Chubby said yes. So it went on forever. It made the lead story on Entertainment Tonight. And I remember my parents calling me at the time they were in Mexico and they said, oh, we're so proud of you. You're on Entertainment Tonight. I said, no, this
That's
isn't
not the
anything.
Best way.
No, this isn't. This is nothing to be proud of.
Oh, no.
Though we didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
And so we fought it and fought it and fought it. There was many discoveries and all that. And in the end, it was dropped. But we could not recoup our money because Chubby had no money. And that lawyer was let go from his firm because he had made a deal with Chubby that you'll pay me once we get paid. But they never got paid.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, so.
And of course, all the only people who benefited from that were the lawyers.
Exactly. As always.
Yeah, as always.
As always. Our lawyers, because the other lawyer didn't get any money.
Oh.
But we had quite a few lawyers. And and that's not the only time we were sued or attempted to be sued. We never ever did anything to be sued for, but people
will try.
Yeah, like we did a spot for the LCBO and this lawyer and his wife went to a movie on a Sunday afternoon and we had done the cinema spot and they thought the end song was heaven, I'm in heaven, da-da-da-da-da-da. Anyway, it wasn't that at all. The word heaven was mentioned, but she swore it was that song. So all of a sudden we're getting sued for infringing on that song. And and the agency, everybody freaked out and they pulled it out of the cinemas right away. And we re-recorded the song and remixed it and sent it back out. But they made us pay for all the dubs to all the cinemas across Canada. Idiots, okay. We did it because we didn't want to lose more business.
Well, of course.
And those were before digital days, so they literally had to send by courier, whatever it was.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. So lots of excitement.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Lots of excitement in the advertising world. My goodness.
There is.
Yeah.
There
so is. When you were doing, so this was, you know, we're going back to the jingle days. So you went from jingles to like audio production and advertising. What happened there?
Yeah. In the early 80s, I started studying reels from Europe and realized that the Europeans had a whole different approach to music, and we didn't copy it, but it really, really, really influenced me especially. And I started pushing our composers into a different area and trying to convince clients, let's not do a jingle. Let's do more of a soundscape, like a little 30-second movie score or something like that.
So that was the difference, that they weren't writing lyrics. It was
And I think we were the pioneers for that in Canada. Mm-hmm. I will take the credit for that. And musical sound design. So All of a sudden, when I first started, the editors would do all the sound design and we would get it and just write the music. And even the editors would do the mixes. I changed that because I thought, why are the editors doing the sound? So we started doing the sound effects, but also doing sound design with musical instruments rather than just footsteps or whatever, more abstract. And so we started doing that, and a few commercials came in that really warranted that kind of an approach. And they were very good commercials, like highly crafted commercials. And then all of a sudden the shit hit the fan. Like, we were like the number one guys and getting every call there was, and all my competitors hated me. And yeah, and we changed it and we started doing really great commercials. And and it really changed. And so, was there singing? Yes, sometimes, but we treated it like songs. So it'd be a 60-second song or a 30-second song rather than the typical happy-go-lucky jingle. And we still did jingles if it warranted it. And I've done a couple in the last 25 years probably that I had to do.
You didn't want to, but you had to.
Jingles.
After spending your whole beginning career doing jingles, I guess it was enough to move into something different.
Do you want to sound your absolute best when you're being interviewed on a podcast or when you're hosting your own show? I have a podcast episode and free downloadable worksheet called Sounding Your Best as a Podcast Guest off of the audiobrandingpodcast.com main page. Just click on the little square graphic to the left of the player displaying my podcast trailer. It gives you some comprehensive suggestions for where to start or for improving the sound you already have, including the type of microphones to consider and why, ideas for soundproofing your recording environment, and suggestions on how to get the best sound when you're being remotely recorded on services like Riverside FM or Squadcast. Don't let bad audio quality hold you back from being the best podcast guest or host you can be. And of course, if you happen to need voiceover for your intro and outro, feel free to get in touch. I'm happy to help. And now, back to the podcast.
I have to ask now, are there any sound-designed commercials that you particularly remember as being, like, outstanding? Anything that really...
That we did?
Yeah. Anything that you remember that sound design was so integral to it that...
Yeah.
And it was really
one,
successful.
There was one we did, I think it was the early 90s, for Chrysler. And in fact, the director was the guy that turned me on to, hey, why don't you think of things slightly differently? And his name was Gillian Proctor, and he was with Ridley Scott's company. And it was a really abstract commercial. It really had nothing to do with cars. There was no driving footage. It was all these people kind of getting ready to do something. It was very mysterious. And we approached it. It was the first time we used the Fairlight, which was a sampler. And it was a big deal for us to approach it that way. It took a long time and it was very unique, and it cleaned up in every award show everywhere, like globally.
Why do you think that was? Was it just so different from everything
else?
It
was totally different. People had not heard that before. And so then, of course, we started getting calls to do that kind of stuff. And, you know, trends start and everybody wants to jump on the bandwagon. And then for us, the challenge was to keep it fresh, keep going and freshen it all the time. So that was, I think, the claim. That was our claim to fame, shall we say, that we... I was very lucky to hook up with my partner, Steve McKinnon, who was a brilliant composer and a producer. And we, as a team, we really created some amazing stuff, and we were so busy for so many years. And,
I can imagine.
Yeah. It was good. It was very good. And he was brilliant. So together, you know, we did one for Rubbermaid, which was a very well-known one where the percussionists are playing.
I think I remember that one.
Yeah. So we did that, and there was a lot of very abstract, different commercials that people had never seen before, you know, or heard before.
Getting away from the abstract, though, are there any other commercials that you are particularly proud of that maybe happened later?
Yeah. Well, many.
I'm sure there are many. Yes.
I've done hundreds of thousands of commercials.
Yes. Yeah.
So
what was your favorite one to work on, one of your favorites? I mean, it's like children, I know, but
they asked me this at the ceremony the other
night. Oh, did they? Okay.
And I said, I can't think of one. Like, there's too many. What sticks in my mind? We did one for Mercedes, which again was very unique and very simple. It was about this guy, Raymond, who had never tried ice cream before. And it was a great commercial. And it talked about Raymond never having ice cream. And he waited and, you know, he would watch other people have ice cream. But he was, you know, and then one day Raymond decided to have ice cream. And then all of a sudden it cuts to a Mercedes logo. And then the last 10 seconds, it was for Mercedes. But it was so well done and so unique. But the score was very, very, very unique. But yeah, I mean, you know, we did, which is kind of jingly, but it was very well known for Capital One, Hands in My Pocket, which, in fact, Stephen Harper kind of stole it from us and started using it when he was running for prime minister.
Oh, geez. And that's a claim to fame.
Well, I put an end to that very quickly.
Okay.
Yeah, there was some phone calls and some lawyer's letters and that stuff. Yeah. There's so many. There's so many, you know, it's really.
It sounds like a lot of them had to do with storytelling, but in, you know, a smaller, shorter format.
Yeah, and like then... little films. Like there was one we did for Vim, which was fantastic. And again, it won Cannes and everywhere. And it was, you see this woman kind of in a very gray jumpsuit-y kind of outfit. And you see her daughter touching a glass, you know, in jail where you go to visit, well, I'm sure you don't know this.
Well, but, we see it in movies.
In the movies, there's that piece of glass and what. Yeah. So it was kind of like that. And she goes, mama, and the mother goes, baby. And it's like, it's as if she's in jail. And I think the mother says, I'm going to be out soon. And then it cuts a far shot and you see her scrubbing her bathtub. Right. And then it's about Vim. You don't need to do this. Use Vim. And anyway, but that was a very clever commercial and that won many, many awards. And
that sounds wonderful.
Yeah. So there's lots like that.
Yeah. So what do you think separated you from other audio directors? Was it just the sensibility of having European sensibilities, or was it your jazz training early on? Or
definitely not that. Definitely not that.
Okay.
No, definitely not the jazz training. I don't know what it. I just think, you know, I was brought up in a very creative household. My dad was an artist and I was surrounded by amazing art. And he also listened, my parents listened to really cool music. They listened to a lot of jazz and, you know, and Harry Belafonte and all sorts of different people. And that influenced me. I think it's just the kind of person I am. I, I'm, I'm always searching to do better and different. And I was really, really, really highly motivated and very competitive. And I just pushed all our composers to just be different. And I didn't accept, there were many times where I didn't accept the first thing or the first five things I heard, because I, you know, I knew that our edge was being different. So I really pushed that to the very end, to my last commercial in February. That was my last commercial.
Fairly recent though. Yeah.
Yeah. I just retired in February after 50 years. So I think it was, and I think one of the things that separated me from others, and a client once said to me, nobody tries harder than you. Meaning I always delivered, but I really, I looked under every possible stone, and I wanted everybody to be really happy. And so I was very collaborative with clients, and I learned all this just recently. I never sat back and thought how I was perceived in the industry. I knew I was popular because I was really busy, but I assumed people hated me.
Why would you assume that?
Well, because I was very picky. I was hard on myself, and I just didn't settle. And I thought maybe I pissed off a lot of people in the studio, like clients, like they would say, yeah, we're happy. And I go, nah, and I push them. And then when I retired and got this induction, I got over 2,000 notes, letters, phone calls, postings on my social media, recounting stories of how I helped them in their careers and how I was so great to work with because I was so collaborative and I really listened. And that was one of the questions I had to answer, that apparently I was a very good listener. And I was, you know, and part of my job was to interpret what they really meant. When a client came to you and said, you know, we want to hear something, blah, 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 I'd say, that's not really what you want to hear. And I had to interpret. And a lot of them would come, everybody has their own playlist. And a lot, most people can't separate their playlist for what's right for the spot or for anything. You know, it's very personal. And so part of my job was to pull them away from what they thought it should be.
Be a little more
because that's what they listen to on their stereo. And be more objective. And that worked a lot. And so that's why I thought, I'm such a pain in the ass. But then I realized, no, I was loved. And an article came out in Campaign Mag, a lot of articles came out, but I think it was the one in Campaign. And I was driving back from shopping and my girlfriend, we got it on my phone and I said, read it to me. Because I was really, and it was all these interviews with ex-clients, and they, and I started to cry like a number of times while I drove home, because I was like, holy shit. I felt like Sally Fields, you know, they like me. They really like me.
That's a wonderful legacy to have. Yeah.
So it's just recently I understood how well-liked I was. And I did a film called Drive Back Home, which you should see if you haven't. It's with Alan Cumming. Mm-hmm. A very close friend of mine, Michael Clowater, was the director, and it's a fantastic film. And it's on Crave now.
Okay.
And there was a screening at the Paradise back in March, and I happened to be in Toronto, and I went to it. And I'd never seen it on the big screen in a theater. I mean, I mixed it and saw it probably 500 times in a mixed theater, but never in a movie theater. And a bunch of the woman that owned the production house that that Michael was with invited a lot of agency producers. It was really for her more than anything, a promo thing. And all these producers, agency producers that I hadn't seen in years, came up to me and started telling me stories how I saved them from this, or they were junior, and I hadn't thought about any of these things. And I went, really? I don't remember. And they were very specific. So my eyes have been open wide in the last couple of months of how I was perceived, which was really interesting for me.
Yeah, I'm so
very
glad
touching,
to hear that.
Very touching. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Benjamin Caput, a filmmaker, composer, and music producer. And I want to thank you for listening to the Audio Branding Podcast, your best place to learn about using the power of sound to tell your story.
I watched that video that they put together for you on Facebook.
And, oh, the legend. The, yeah. Which one? The,
well,
the knockoff of We Are the Champions?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Yes. That yeah. was a surprise. Like, there was another hilarious. Video. They, it was. They played it. I was the only one that got a video. There was 5 inductees. We all had our introduction video, and mine was by far the worst. Like, it was all stock shots of people in studios, and everybody else's was them in it. And I was like, why didn't they just call me? I could get into a studio. Anyway, so, but then at the end of when they presented everybody the awards before we got into a group discussion, they said, oh, there's another video to play. And then they put it on, and then I hear my name, and I couldn't really see it or hear it. So, but I knew it was about me. And then when I got home, somebody sent me the link, and I was like, holy shit, this is funny.
It was very
touching. And again, yeah. very, very nice. Yeah, yeah. 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 So yeah, that was good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so you've been doing this a long time. I mean, obviously, you know, you don't get inducted like that if you haven't. You've yeah, done a yeah. lot, well, a lot of stuff.
As I said, 50 years.
50 years,
in
yeah.
the advertising. I think I'm the last man standing. I am the last man standing of my generation. And I've been through, I was kind of moving into my 5th generation of clients. Like, I'm working wow. with grandchildren of clients. I'm 71, so mm-hmm. I'm an old guy. But yeah, I was like working with grandchildren of clients from the, you know, the 70s and 80s.
But I mean, how rewarding must that be? That's,
oh,
you know,
great.
You're getting to
it
see
great.
It all develop.
Yeah.
This has been part one of our interview. I hope you'll tune in next week for part two. Well, that's the end of this episode. Thanks for listening. And if you like what you heard, why not tell a friend about this podcast? It's available in all the usual locations. Until next time.